Amen. It was August in the year 1896 in the far southeast corner of Alaska, Dawson City, Alaska, which is exactly where the Yukon and the Klondike Rivers come together. And in that year, as miners were up in that wilderness, they struck gold. And the Klondike Gold Rush was on. Now, this was a gold rush like we had never before seen in our United States history. Alaska was not a state, it was just a territory. And the connections and the transportation going up into Alaska were very, very sparse. So, word came down out of Dawson City, out of the Klondike, down into Seattle, and from Seattle across the telegraph lines down into San Francisco. California had just had a gold strike in 1849, not that many years before, only a generation before. They knew what gold rushes were about. The gold rush in the Black Hills was now about 20 years old. And so you had across the United States those prospectors, those miners who were ready for a new adventure. Now, if you were going to the Klondike in 1896, you had two choices. You could either trek across country, which meant that you had to go up through the Pacific Northwest, up and through the west coast of Canada, and then up into Alaska. Can you even imagine that? It's a long enough journey today on the Can-Am Highway. That was a very, very difficult way to do it. So the easier of the two, which was still fabulously difficult, was to get on a ship in San Francisco, in Seattle, in Portland, and up the west coast of Canada you would go to the port of Skagway in Alaska. Now, here started some of the very, very unique things about this gold rush. The government would not allow you to go in and make a claim unless you took with you one entire year of supplies. You see, the Klondike was so remote, and it was all permafrost. There was not a way to grow enough food to support everyone. And if you went up without food, one of two things was going to happen. Either you were going to starve, or the locals were going to starve after you bought all their food. No starvation, and so you had to take with you all of your supplies. And so snowshoes went on, and after you got to Skagway, and after you bought your supplies, you had to now go on foot. Oh, you could not hook up your sled dog to that dog sled, because the first thing you had to do was go up and over the mountains. You had to either take the Chilicot Trail or the White Pass Trail, but either way, you had to go up and over the mountains. Stop. Put two and two together with what I just said. There were no roads, there were trails over the mountains. On that trail that led down into Klondike, down to the Yukon River, it was littered with dead horses. And what people wound up doing, 100,000, mostly men, wound up trying to make it down into the gold fields. Actually, only about 30,000 of those made it into the gold fields themselves. In order to get the supplies there, if you had a ton of supplies, what this meant was you started with what you could carry, you took it up, came back, got more, took it up, came back, got more, took it up, came back, got more. When all of your stuff was there, you did it again. And then you did it again, along with the other 90,000 men who were on the trail with you. Entire lines of men, and sometimes those tough women who were there and with them as they made their way over the mountains, up the pass, down to the Yukon River, onto the ships, and floating down to Dawson City in August 1896, Dawson City had 500 people. By the summer of 1898, not even 2 years later, Dawson City had 30,000 people. people. And so the gold rush broke. And when you got up there, this was not the same. You know, you and I know gold rushes. We know what went up on in Deadwood. Now, picture Deadwood in all of the chaos, except now frozen solid, because it was all permafrost. Now, picture it in a place where you couldn't get supplies in. It was extremely demanding. Those prospectors, those businessmen who went up there, learned very quickly that there were many kinds of people who were there with them. One kind of person who was with them was the kind of person that you could trust at any and all times. You could trust some of those prospectors, some of those people coming up and down the trail, that if you were in trouble, they were going to stop and help you. They would literally give you the shirt off their back. They would literally share food with you. They would literally keep you alive. They would literally get you to medical help. That you learned which person you could trust. But at the same time, there were people that you had to fear. There were people who would just as soon stab you in the back as give you a hand up. Now, how are you going to tell the difference between the two? There were people in the Klondike that you needed to fear. Well, this is what we talk about today. How is it that I can dare you to dare to face the fear of the other? Because the fact of the matter is that all of us fear other people in some way, shape, or form. Now, maybe if I just change the word, instead of saying the word fear, what if I use the word distrust? There are some people in this world that you need to not trust, and there are others that you can trust. What if I say it this way? You know, around that person, you just need to be cautious. There are other people that you don't need to be cautious with. But we learn in different ways, at different levels, how to deal with the fear of the other. This is what I want to equip you with today. How do we dare to face the fear of the other? How did Jesus do it? And Jesus was invited to a wedding. You know, when he was about 29 years old, Jesus started ministry. And he went to the Jordan River, and there he was baptized with John. When he came up out of that, he went out into the wilderness for about a month and a half. There he ate very little, drank very little. He was fasting, he was centering, he was praying, he was focusing. And when he stepped out of the wilderness, he had a brand new clarity of who he was and what he was to be doing. And one of the first things that he did was to start calling disciples. It was two brothers over on the coast of the Sea of Galilee, and then they walked down the coast just a little way, and there were two more brothers, and then he began to call others. And at some point in there, Jesus went to a wedding. And his mother was involved. She was invited. And the disciples came. Now, remember, a wedding then was not like a wedding today. Today, you and I get a written invitation in the mail, and we show up at the church or the park or the house or wherever it's going to be, and in 20 minutes, 30 minutes, that wedding ceremony is done, and then we go to the reception, and then we go home. Not in Jesus' day. There was no such thing as a written invitation. And so they would send out word. They would say, oh, by the way, next month, about 4 weeks from now on a Tuesday or so, there's going to be a wedding, and we'd love for your family to come. And when everything was ready, whether it was on a Wednesday or a Thursday, when everything was ready, they would send the messengers out and say, okay, come on. And this was not a 20-minute deal. This was not a three-hour go-to-the-reception-and-you're-going-home event. You come and you celebrate, and you would dance, and there was music, and there was community, and people would stay overnight, and there would be more, and there would be wine, and there would be food, and there would be celebration. And Jesus went. And when the messengers came to him and he said, hey, I have some friends, can I bring them too? And they said, absolutely. And so Jesus and the disciples went to the wedding. And at the wedding, they ran out of wine. Now, one of the things that I love about the stories in John is there are huge holes in this. Really, seriously, you planned a wedding and then you didn't have enough to feed the people? You didn't have enough wine to go around? What was that about? And while they were there, Jesus' mother Mary started elbowing him and saying, look, they're out of wine. Deal with it. Help them. Punk. What was that? If this were Jesus' first miracle, which is what the author of John tells us, well, let me ask you this. When's the last time that you were to some place and you started elbowing the person next to you and saying, here, change this water into wine, will you? How did she know to elbow him? How did she know to, I don't know. I have no idea what that was about. And Jesus said, Mom, you know it's not my time. I'm not ready for this. And then he went ahead and did it anyway. I don't know why. I have no idea. All the holes in this story that are so wonderful, he just decided it was time. And so there were five or six big jars that held 20 to 30 gallons. Okay, so at max, we would have been looking at about 180 gallons. And Jesus said, okay, go fill those up. They filled them up with water, and Jesus scooped out some water and gave it to the servants and said, take it up to the steward. And the steward tasted this. Now, mind you, do you notice what didn't happen? Jesus did not take the wine himself. And the servants did not say where the wine came from. Can you imagine that conversation? And the steward says to the servants, wow, this is really good. Where'd you get it? Out of the foot washing jars? No, they weren't going to tell anybody where this came from. And then the steward does not go to Jesus. They didn't tell him that Jesus had done this. He went to the groom and said, wow, great wine. Thank you. I want you to see what Jesus did. Down beneath this story is a humble Jesus who reached out in love to serve others. He didn't need credit. Nobody needed to know. He didn't tell anyone. He just did it, reaching out in love and service to others. It would be one thing if we could interpret this story by simply looking at a wedding in Cana. But it is not enough to do that, because what I want you to see is what went on around that. Let me tell you about the political landscape that Cana was in at that moment in time. You need to know this and realize the context of what was going on. Cana was in Galilee. It was a small town in the northern part. This part of the world had been under Roman rule for around 90 years. It was extremely Jewish. The Jews hated the Romans. They wanted nothing more than to get them out of there. The taxation system alone was a nightmare. You see, it was a three-tiered system. On the top, you had the Roman emperor, who was taxing everybody in the Roman Empire, but then, you and I would call that the federal income tax. But then underneath it was a state income tax. Herod was ruler over that area at that time, and he had an entire tax system. And underneath that was a Jewish temple tax system. And the Romans were brilliant in how they did this. They wrapped it all up and intertwined all of it so you couldn't separate it. You couldn't simply say, oh, I'll pay that one, but not that one. They rolled it all up and made the Jewish officials do it. The temple was up to its eyeballs in political intrigue and twisting people's elbows in order to get them to pay the taxes. And the Jews hated it. There were people in that area of the country who had up to a 90% taxation rate. And if you could not pay your taxes, your landlord came in and said, "Well, then I guess I get your property." And what you were seeing was a monstrous transition as people were taking property, and the rich got richer and the poor got poorer. And with that was political oppression. What happens when you have enough political oppression? Rebellion. Jesus was raised in the town of Nazareth. Nazareth was 4 miles away from the city of Sepphoris. In the year 4 BC, which was approximately the year that Jesus was born, there was a rebellion that started in Sepphoris, and the Jews tried to throw off the Roman government. They wanted Israel to be free once more. The Romans would have nothing of that. They came in with soldiers, they came in with weaponry, and they obliterated the town of Sepphoris. They burned it, they knocked it down, and then what we see in history is that they made 2,000 crosses, lined the roads with them, and crucified so everybody could see and hear and smell the smell of death. And this is what happens when you cross the Roman government. And Jesus went to a wedding in the middle of that. Why would John ever lead off with a story of love and joy? But he did. This is what I want you to see. Jesus lived in the midst of an entire culture, an entire society, where you had to be afraid. You had to fear the Romans. You had to fear the people who were cooperating with the Romans. You had to fear and know who to trust and not to trust. How did Jesus react to that? He did not react by staying home. Isn't it? I mean, we just don't even think about this. Jesus could have stayed in Nazareth, drawn himself back. He could have loved people there in Nazareth. He could have healed people in Nazareth. He could have taught in Nazareth. He could have done miracles in Nazareth. He could have stayed right there, but he didn't. Instead of loving less, Jesus asserted himself out into the country and loved people more, surrounded by fear, surrounded by political intrigue. Oh my gosh, is it any different today? We have learned how to fear other people. Sometimes we learn how to fear people who are different from us religiously. Oh my goodness, my mother told me the story that when she was 20 years old in World War II, she came home and her mother, my grandmother, said to her, "Just so you know, the day that you marry, that you are engaged to a Catholic boy, is the day that you are evicted from this house and disowned." Really? Grandma, what was that? You and I mean, I think nothing of that. Our dearest neighbors across the street are St. Joseph's. I love the relationship. And how many weddings have I done as a pastor that are between Catholic and Methodist? This is a non-issue, but I'll tell you what, it was an issue then. Sometimes we learn to fear, to distrust, to be cautious, to hold at arm's length those people who are different from us religiously, culturally, linguistically. You have a different language. You have a different accent. Those who dress differently from us, those who have different hairstyles, those who have different political beliefs, we learn to fear, to distrust, and to hold at arm's length those who are different from us. What did Jesus do? Jesus did not accept that. The people that he was not supposed to hang out with, he hung out with. And Jesus spent time talking with prostitutes. Women. He talked with women. Good Jewish boys don't do that. He talked with lepers. Good heavens, he touched lepers. What? Good Jewish boys don't do that. He talked with a woman caught in adultery. No, no, listen, good Jewish boys don't do that. He did not love less. Jesus took himself and in the face of fear, reached out and loved more. Now, you and I need to understand that we have been dared to face the fear of others, but you must be wise. You have to be wise. You have to be smart about this. All right, so I was in college. I was walking across a shopping mall parking lot one day, and I was with my college roommate, Frank. And there, right near us, was a pickup with a topper on, with windows in the back. The windows were open on this beautiful summer day, and there, in the window of the pickup, was this gorgeous Rottweiler. Oh my gosh, it was this huge, beautiful dog. And I put on my best dog whisperer attire, and I thought, I'm gonna go pet this dog. I held out my hand, palm down, so he could smell me. I walked slowly. I talked with him the whole way. He was having none of this. He was growling. He was barking. He was mad. He had his fangs barred. And I thought, how can you not like me? And so I'm walking toward him until the moment where my college roommate, Frank, walks up beside me and took my arm and said, no, don't do this. I am pleased to tell you that today I have 5 fingers on my right hand. Because of that, he would have taken my hand right off. There is a good reason why we have fear of other people, and you have to be wise. Jesus himself even talked about this. He told his disciples, when you go into another town, if they welcome you, stay there, eat with them, bless them. But if you go into a new town and they do not welcome you, turn around, shake the dust off your feet, and leave. Even Jesus spoke about the wisdom. We must be wise when we are dealing with people that we fear. But Jesus also said, don't back off. You don't love less, you love more. This is the invitation. This is the invitation that says we are invited to follow Jesus' example and to love. Today, we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. weekend. My favorite words of his are found in his I Have a Dream speech. Oh my goodness, if you ever have a chance to listen to him, that dog could preach. Oh my gosh, he was amazing. And he did the exact same thing that Jesus did. In nonviolence, he didn't back off. In love, he loved more. Here are some of the words that he spoke in 1963 from Washington, D.C., on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. And he said this, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today, Abraham Lincoln, signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon of light, of hope, to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to taking the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time. Now, what I love about this, the name of this speech is I Have a Dream. I found out 2 weeks ago that he stayed up until 3 o'clock that morning trying to write this speech. He wrote it by hand, and then he crossed it out and rewrote it. He wrote it, he scribbled, and even up to the point where he stepped up to the podium, it was not done. He did not have the words, I have a dream, in his manuscript. Those words came to him as he was speaking this speech. This was how impassioned he was. I have a dream. And he said this, I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day little black boys and little black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and little white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places shall be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is the prophet Isaiah, 3,000 years old. This is our hope. He didn't back off. He didn't love less. He loved more. And Jesus went to a wedding in Cana. He didn't love less. He loved more. He loved more and more and more over the next 3 years in the face of fear, in the face of oppression, in the face of injustice. He loved more. This is what I'm inviting you. I'm inviting you to dare to face the fear of the other. Not guarding and hiding, but being wise. Being wise and loving more. And in order to do that, we have to claim our faith. Surely it is God who saves me. I will trust in him and not be afraid. For the Lord is my stronghold and my sure defense, and he will be my savior. These are the words that Isaiah speaks. They are words of wisdom, and this is what I'm inviting you into. May it be this week that you face your fear of the other. It's very real. It's very legitimate. Face the fear.